Elaine Dundy, The Dad Avocado. Chapter 1. It was a hot, peaceful, optimistic sort of day in September. It was around 11 in the morning, I remember, and I was drifting down the Boulevard Saint-Michel, thoughts rising in my head like little puffs of smoke, when suddenly a voice billowed into my ear. Sally J. Gorse? What the hell? Well, for Christ's sake, can this really be our own little Sally J. Gorse? I felt a hand ruffling my hair, and I swung around, furious at being so rudely awakened. Who should be standing there, in front of me, in what I immediately spotted as the left bank uniform of the day, dark wool shirt, and a pair of old army suntons, but my old friend Larry Keevil? He was staring down at me with some alarm. I said hello to him, and added that he had frightened me to cover any bad-tempered expression that might have been lingering on my face, but he just kept on staring dumbly at me. What have you been up to since... When the hell was it that I last saw you? He asked finally. Curiously enough, I remembered exactly. It was just a week after I got here, the middle of June. He kept on looking at me, or rather he kept on looking over me in that surprised way, and then he shook his head and said, Christ, Gorse, can it only be 3 short months? Then he grinned. You've really flung yourself into this, haven't you? In a way, it was exactly what I had been thinking too, and I was on the point of saying, into what? Very innocently, you know, so that he could tell me how different I was, how much I had changed and so forth. But all at once, something stopped me. I knew I would have died rather than hear his reply. So instead I said, ah, well, don't we all? Which was my stock phrase when I couldn't think of anything else to say. There was a pause, and then he asked me how I was, and I said, fine, how was he? And he said, fine, and I asked him what he was doing, and he said it would take too long to tell. It was then we both noticed we were standing right across the street from the Café du Pont, the one near the Sorbonne. Shall we have a quick drink? I heard him ask, needlessly, for I was already halfway across the street in that direction. The café was very crowded, and the only place we could find was on the very edge of the pavement. We just managed to squeeze under the shade of the awning. A waiter came and took our order. Larry leant back into the hum and buzz and brouhaha and smiled lazily. Suddenly, without quite knowing why, I found I was very glad to have run into him. And this was odd, because two Americans re-encountering each other after a certain time in a foreign land are supposed to clamber up their nearest lampposts and wait tremblingly for it all to blow over. Especially me. I had made a vow when I got over here never to speak to anyone I had ever known before. Yet, here we are, two Americans who hadn't really seen each other for years. Here was someone from home who knew me when, if you like, and instead of shambling back into the bushes like a startled rhino, I was absolutely thrilled at the whole idea. I like it here, don't you? Said Larry, indicating the café with a turn of his head. I had to admit, I had never been there before. He smiled quizzically. You should come more often, he said. It's practically the only non-tourist trap to survive on the left bank. It's real, he added. Real, I thought, whatever that meant. I looked at the Sorbonne students surging around us, the tables fairly rocking under their pounding fists and thumping elbows. The whole vast panoramic carpet seemed to be woven out of old boots, checkered wool and wild, fuzzy hair. I don't suppose there is anything on earth to compare with a French student café in the late morning. You couldn't possibly reproduce the same numbers, noise, and intensity anywhere else without producing a riot as well. It really was the most colored, too. There was an especially large number of Sinhalese, Arab, and African students, along with those from every other country. I suppose Larry's reality in this case was based on the cafe's internationality. But perhaps all cafes near a leading university have that authentic international atmosphere. At the table closest to us sat an ordinary-looking young girl with lank yellow hair and a grey-haired, bespectacled middle-aged man. They had been conversing fiercely, but quietly, for some time now in a language I was not even able to identify. All at once I knew that I liked this place too. Jammed in on all sides with the goodish Tower of Babel working itself up to a frenzy around me, I felt safe and anonymous, and most of all, thankful we were going to be spared those devastating and shattering revelations one was always being treated to at the more English-speaking cafes like the Fleur. And, as I said, I was very glad to have run into Larry. We talked a little about the various cafes, and he explained carefully to me which were the tourist traps and which weren't. Glancing down at my Pernod, I discovered to my astonishment that I had already finished it. Time was whizzing past. I felt terribly excited. "White smoke," said Larry, clicking his tongue disapprovingly at my second Pernod. His hand twirled around the stem of his own virtuous glass of San Rafael. "You keep that up," he said, tapping my glass, "and it will blow your head off, which may be a good thing at that." "Why pink?" he asked, studying my new coiffure carefully. "Why not green?" As a matter of fact, I had had my hair dyed a marvelous shade of pale red, so popular with Parisian tards that season. It was the first direct remark he made about the new me, and it was hardly encouraging. Slowly his eyes left my hair and travelled downwards. This time he really took in my outfit, and then that look that I'm always encountering, that special one composed in equal parts of amusement, astonishment, and horror, came over his face. "I'm not a moron, and I can generally guess what causes this look. The trouble is, it's always something different." I squirmed uncomfortably, feeling his eyes bearing down on my bare shoulders and breasts. "What the hell are you doing in the middle of the morning with an evening dress on?" he asked me finally. "Sorry about that," I said quickly, "but it's all I've got to wear. My laundry hasn't come back yet." He nodded, fascinated. "I thought if I wore this red leather belt with it, people wouldn't actually notice, especially since it's such a warm day. I mean, these tantiaries make it so difficult for you to get your laundry to them in the first place, don't they? Closing up like that from noon till 3? I mean, my gosh, it's the only time I'm up and around over here, don't you think?" Oh, sure, said Larry and murmured, Jesus, under his breath. Then he smiled forgivingly. Oh, well, you're young, you're new. You will learn, of course. A wise nod of the head. I know your type, all right. My type? I wondered. My type of what? Of tourists, of course. I gasped and then smiled cunningly to myself. Tourist indeed! Ho ho! That was the last thing I could be called. Did he but know. Tell me about this, I said. You seem to have tourists on the brain. He crossed his legs and pulled out of his shirt pocket a crumpled pack of cigarettes, as dupes as possible, sort of galois nothings. Offered one to me, took one himself, lit them both, and then settled back with pleasure. This was obviously one of his favorite subjects. Basically, he began, the tourists can be divided into two categories. The organized, that is organized. Under the organized, you find two distinct types. First, the eager beaver culture vulture, with the list 10 yards long, who just manages to get it all crossed off before she collapses of aesthetic indigestion each night and has to be carried back to her hotel. And second, the cool, suave sophisticate, who comes gliding over gracefully, calmly, and indifferently. But don't be fooled by the indifference. This babe is determined to maintain her incorruptible standards of cleanliness and efficiency if the entire staff of her hotel dies trying. She belongs to the take your own toilet paper set. Stuffs her suitcases full of nylon, Kleenex, soap flakes, and DDT bombs. Immediately learns the rules of the country. I mean, what time the shops open and close, and how much to tip the waiter. Can pack for a weekend in a small jewel case and a large handbag, and still have enough room for her own soap and wash rag. Finds the hairdresser who speaks English, the restaurant who knows how she likes her steak, and the first foreign word she makes, absolutely sure of pronouncing correctly, is the one for drugstore. After that, she's all set, and the world is her ashtray. If she's got enough money, she's got no trouble at all. On the whole, I rather like her. So far, so good, I told myself. They neither one have the slightest, smallest, remotest connection with me. Then a thought caught me sharply. And they're disorganized? I asked rather nervously. The disorganized? He considered me carefully for a moment, narrowing his eyes. Your cigarette's gone out, he said finally. You have to smoke this kind, you know. They won't smoke themselves. He lit it for me again and blew out the match without once taking his eyes off my decolletage, which was slipping quite badly. I gave it a tug and he resumed the discourse. Yes, that is organized. They get split into two groups as well. First of all, the sly one. The idea is to see Europe casually, you know, sort of vaguely, out of the corner of the eye. All Baedekers and Michelins and museum catalogues immediately discarded as too boring and too corny. Who wants to see a pile of old stones anyway? The general feel of the country is what she's after. It's even a struggle to get her to look at the map of the city she's in, so she will know where the hell she is. And actually, it's a useless one, since this type is constitutionally incapable of reading a map, and has no sense of direction to begin with. But, as I say, she's the sly one. There. Oh, look, that's the Louvre over there, isn't it? I think I'll drop in for a second. I'm rather hot. We'd better get out of the sun anyway. Or, Tuileries, did you say? That sure strikes a bell. Aren't those flowers pretty over there? Now, haven't I heard something about it in connection with the... what was it? French Revolution? Oh yes, of course. That's it. Thank you, hon. I laughed. A jolly laugh, to show I was with him. The funny thing, he continued, is, scratch the sly one and out comes the real fanatic, and what begins with, gosh, I can never remember whether Romanesque was before or after Gothic, leads to secret pamphlet readings and stained glass studies, and ends up in wild aesthetic discussions of the relative values of the two towers at Chartres. Then all restraint is thrown to the wind, and anything really old enough is greeted with animal cries of anguish at its beauty. In the final stage, small discriminating lists appear about her person, but they only contain, you may be damned sure, the good, the pure, and the truly worthwhile. Larry paused, took a small, discriminating sip of his Saint Raphael, and puffed happily away at his cigarette. I swallowed the last of my Pernod, folded my arms seductively on the sticky table, and took a long pull on my own French cigarette. It had gone out, of course. I hid it from Larry, but he hadn't noticed. He was lost in reverie. Blushingly, I recalled the night, not so long before, when I had suddenly fallen in love with the Place de Fürstenberg in the moonlight. I had actually, oh Lord, I had actually kissed one of the stones at the fountain, I remembered, flung my shoes off, and executed a crazy drunken dance. The September sun was blazing down on us, and the second Pernod was beginning to have a pleasant, soporific effect on me. A couple of street Arabs came up and listlessly began to try selling us silver jewelry and rugs. After a while, they drifted away. I began studying Larry closely. The mat of auburn hair curling to his skull, the grey-green eyes now so blank and far away, the delicate scar running down the pale skin of his forehead, the well-shaped nose covered with a faint spray of freckles, and his large mouth so gently curved, all contributed to give his face, especially in repose, a look of sappy sweetness that was sharply at odds with, and yet at the same time enhanced, his tough, wise guy manner. Maybe because I had been out very late the night before and was not able to put up my usual resistance, but it seemed to me, sitting there with the sound of his voice dying in my ears, that I could fall in love with him. And then, as unexpected as a hidden step, I felt myself actually stumble and fall. And there it was. I was in love with him. As simple as that. He was the first real person I had ever been in love with. I couldn't get over it. What I was trying to figure out was why I had never been in love with him before. I mean, I'd had plenty of chance to. I had seen him almost daily that summer in Maine, 2 years ago, when we were both in a summer stock company. I had decided to be an actress at that time. Even though we were about the same age, he was already a full-fledged equity member, and I had been a mere apprentice. He was always rather nice to me in his insolent way. But there was also, I now remember it with a passing pang, an utterly ravishing girl, a model, the absolute epitome of glamour, called Lila. She used to come up at weekends to see him. Then I heard from someone that he'd quit college the next winter and gone abroad to become a genius. I'd met him again when I first landed in Paris. He'd been very nice, bought me a drink, taken down my telephone number, and never called me. "You are a dead duck now," I told myself as I relaxed back into my coma. "You're gone." I looked at him, smiling idly. I tried to imagine what was going on in his mind. I gave up and I thought of his tourists. I had no trouble imagining the girl with all the Kleenex and Tampax or whatever. Cool, blonde, and slender, she was only too easy to picture. But the thought of all that unruffled poise somehow had the opposite effect on my own. So I drove her away and began concentrating on the last one. What did he call her? The sly one. Here, happily, in my pleasantly drowsy state, I was able to dress up a little grey furry mouse with tail and whiskers in a black bombazine coat and bonnet. She was clutching a small discriminating list in her white-gloved claws, and uttering animal squeals of anguish at the beauty of, what, a crazy horse saloon? Oh dear, I really was too ignorant and too lazy to know what was on that list. Something old. Those caves, I thought idly, the word conjuring up no picture whatever. Those caves, anyway, I persevered. In southern France? No, Spain. Someplace with an A. Ha! Altamira. That's it. Yes, the caves, I decided, framing the mouse in the doorway, or rather, caveway. Yes. They're very old. Very, very old. The last type, said Larry, his voice suddenly snapping me out of my trance, his green eyes fixing me with a significant glare that made my heart large. The last type is the wildcat. The "I'm a fugitive from the convent of the Sacred Heart." Not that it's ever really the case. Just seems so from the violence of the reaction. Anyhow, it's her first time free, and her first time across, and by golly, she goes native in a way the natives never had the stamina to go. Some people think it's those stand-up toilets they have here. You know, the ones with the iron footprints you're supposed to straddle. After the shock of that kind of plumbing, something snaps in the American girl, and she's off. The desire to bathe somehow gets lost. The hell with all that, she figures. Then weird haircuts, weird hair colors, weird clothes. Then comes drink and down, down, down. Dancing in the streets all night, braying at the moon, and waking up in a different bed each morning. Yep. He polished off his San Rafael with a judicious smack of his lips. That's the lot. Hmm. A long, studying glance. Now, you, I would say. You are going to be a combination of the last two types. Why, you utter bastard! I gasp. That's a dirty lie! I heard myself saying, the phrase dug up from heaven knows what depths of my childhood. Then, in an effort to regain my dignity, really, of all the stupefyingly inaccurate accusations, It's a pretty safe bet. I bathe about 60 times as often as you. He burst out laughing. To accuse the American male of not bathing in Paris is merely to flatter him. The Pernod was having quite a different effect on me now. I was wide awake and sputtering, and so angry I could almost feel the steam rising from my shoulders. He put his hand over mine, the one with the dead cigarette crumbled in it, and gave me a wonderful smile. Easy, child. Easy. I'm only teasing you. Don't think I disapprove, for Christ's sake. Live it up, I say. Don't say no to life, Gorse. You are only young once. We were on last name terms, Hevel and I. I'm finding your grand old man just as hard to take as your scientific researcher, I said as nastily as I could, and withdrew my hand. I like you, Gorse, he said. I mean it. Had my eye on you that summer. High-spirited. He laughed, but at the same time, I knew, by the way his motor had started up, you could actually see the engine chugging through his body, and the way he was vaguely looking around for a waiter, that the interview, as far as he was concerned, was over. And he was on his way. Please order me another Pernod, I said quickly. Raised eyebrows. Oh, for goodness sake, I'm all right. And have one yourself. Please, let me pay for this round. He was the sort of person whose financial circumstances were impossible to guess at. And the quick, cynical look he gave me made me start to apologize. But as he didn't refuse, I went on. Please, I simply must talk to you. I'm in the most awful mess. And I sighed and buried my head in my hands, stalling for time. He signaled the waiter and ordered another round. Okay, he said. Let's have it. What's it all about? Give me a minute, I pleaded desperately. I can't just jump in like that. My thoughts were chasing each other all over the place, but nothing seemed to sort itself out. Advice, I thought. Ask his advice. On love? Finance? Career? Better stick to love, I decided. It's what's on your mind anyway. And with that, my mind went blank. Only one small irrelevancy finally appeared. Why are all your tourists she? I finally asked. Because all tourists are she, he replied promptly. No males at all? Don't be silly. No. No males at all. The only male tourists, though naturally there are men visitors, you know, men visiting foreign countries, he explained maddeningly. The only male tourists are the ones loping around after their wives. A tourist is a she, all right, he said, finishing it off with a lot of very reminiscent laughter. I can see you've made quite a study of them, I snarled scornfully. I get around, Gorse. I get around. And you, I told myself, are just one of the mob. It was no joke being in love with Larry. I could see that now. It really hit me for the first time. The waiter had brought us fresh drinks and was pouring the water into my pernod, and ordinarily this would have quite a cheering effect on me. Its changing colour usually reminded me of chemistry sets and magic potions, but now the cloudy green liquid looked merely poisonous, and the strong licorice smell reminded me of nothing so much as a bottle of old grandma's cough remedy. Hold your nose and have a piece of chocolate quickly afterwards. I found that the previous drinks had turned icy cold and heavy in my stomach. I felt terribly sober, and did the inside of my mouth tasted sour. I sighed and picked up the chits, 120 francs. "It's cheap anyway," I said, giving him the money. I said, staring at the drink, trying to get up enough courage to down it. "What's eating you, Gars? Come on, let's have it." His words rang out like coins in the emptiness, and I suddenly noticed how still everything around us had become. The students had stopped surging and gone to lunch. The Arab vendors were asleep in the sun, and the waiters, even as we watched, stopped waiting and began drifting back to their stations, where they came to a standstill, or as near a standstill as they ever got, still rocking gently back and forth on their heels, heartbeats of perpetual motion gently rocking back and forth, their napkins fluttering in the breeze. The sun shone on, the shade of the awning vanished in the hot, white, shadowless midday. In that blaze of heat, I was loving Paris as never before. And there, sitting opposite me, stretching himself luxuriously in the sun, his eyes lazily examining his half-empty drink, was Larry, the one I loved the best, sensationally uninterested. All at once, I sat bolt upright and let out a yelp. I suddenly remembered what I was doing that arrondissement in the first place. I had been, in fact, on my way to the Sorbonne to meet my lover, who was attending an international students' conference there for his embassy. And, at that very moment, as if I myself had conjured him, though I suppose I must have unconsciously registered him in the corner of my eye, he came striding along the boulevard, large as life. Teddy Alfredo Urselli Visconti himself, looking suave and late and Latin and livid. I glanced at my watch. Wow, I was just an hour too late. Then, stupidly, I tried to hide my head with my hands. It was too late, of course, and the worst of it was he had also caught me trying to hide. Being a Latin, seeing me there with a young and handsome man, he naturally put two and two together, and for once in his life arrived at the right answer about me. In a panic, I knew that he must not sit down with us. If he did, he would stay and Larry would go, and that would be that. There wasn't a moment to be lost. Without explanation, I dashed over to the street corner to intercept him. "So, I've caught you at last, have I?" he said, in that half-serious, half-teasing man-of-the-world voice he always reserved for matters of the heart. Whatever guilt I felt vanished in my exasperation. "We can't all lead a triple life as successfully as you do," I replied coolly, and saw a really desperate, haggard look come over his face. "He's an old friend," I added hastily. "He's brought me news of home." Very important news. I see, he said stiffly. Very well. We must talk of all this tonight. At the Ritz? Yup. He always brought out the succinct in me. Shall we say at 11 o'clock then, as usual? Not later? He was always up to a half an hour late. It may be difficult to get away, he said, but I shall certainly try to be on time if I can. He looked so pleased I could have killed him. If I hadn't been in such a hurry to get back to Larry, I would have told him then and there, as I'd been vaguely planning to do for about a week, how hellishly bored I was with all his sophisticated maneuvers. It was partly out of necessity, of course, having both a wife and a mistress, as well as myself, that he jumped and juggled his days and nights with arranged and rearranged rendezvous. But that was not the only reason he always turned up so late. There was another one, as I suspected when he formed the habit of meeting me around 11 at the Ritz bar. It was that he simply refused to do anything in a straightforward way. He felt that his unpunctuality increased his mystery and desirability. The unfortunate thing was that he had reckoned without my naivety. I was honestly so thrilled at being at the Ritz in the first place that I didn't mind how long I was kept waiting. There were so many marvelous new things to look at, and so many marvelous new drinks to experiment with, Sazeracs and slings and heaven knows what else, so that at first I never even noticed the passing of time. But then, as the novelty wore off and I took to bringing magazines and novels along with me, I noticed how really put out he was when, instead of discovering me ceaselessly scanning the horizon for him, he found me deep in Paris Match. As I hurriedly said goodbye to Teddy, meekly apologizing for not meeting him at the Sorbonne and promising to see him at the Ritz that evening, I had a sinister premonition of how embarrassing an homme fatal could be when his charms are no longer fatal to you. I turned around to find Larry quietly taking in the scene. When he caught my eye, he began grinning from ear to ear. I felt my ankles wobble under me. "Watch out!" he shouted as I walked towards him. "You are going to knock over that chair." But of course it was too late. Larry was really enjoying himself now. He laughed and laughed when I returned. "Gorse, oh gorse," he chortled, neighing like a barnyard in uproar. "If you are his mistress, and I think you are, you've skipped a grade, honey." A woggle of his forefinger. "That's not for first-year tourists. That's for the second-year ones, you know." At this point, I now realized there were several things I could have done. For instance, I could have nodded sheepishly or good-naturedly or whatever one does with good grace. I could have said, "Well, there you have me, I guess." And he would have said, "Now, never mind. What was it you wanted to tell me?" And I would have said, "Nothing. Forget it." And he would have replied, "Well, cheer up. See you around sometime." And he would have, I suppose, sometime. Our Paris, after all, was really very small. And I would have at least been spared one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. No, honestly, I don't think anything has embarrassed me so much since. It's crazy, but I wonder if all the rest of it, and I mean all the rest of it, would have happened if our meeting had ended then and there and in that way. Who knows? But anyway, seeing myself and the affair with Teddy suddenly through Larry's eyes, and realizing that whatever I had done, however original I had thought of it as being before, I was only remaining strictly within the tourist pattern, and having Larry know this, well, at the time it was too much to bear. To have an affair with a man, and one's a very first affair at that, just because he picks you up under rather romantic circumstances on the Champs-Élysées, takes you to the Ritz and things, and above all, because you are impressed with the fact that he has a wife and mistress already. What could be more predictable? Tourist second year disorganized. No, damn it, I wasn't going to be stuffed into that category no matter what. Not in Larry's mind, anyway. Here is my advice to you, and you are old enough to give it to yourself, Larry was saying sagely. Stay away from married men. I mean it. Stay away. How can you think such things of me? It's not that way at all, I moaned. We love each other. There is no wife in this at all. How could you think such a thing of me? There is something much worse, though. A crackpot at the Italian embassy who's always hated Teddy. Do you know what he's done? He's broken into Teddy's flat and burned some important papers so that Teddy got into the most awful trouble and he's been recalled. He has to leave any day now. God knows if he'll ever be able to straighten this out. It's torture. We can never meet except briefly, like you saw us now and in the open, as if there were nothing to it, for fear of getting that man onto my trail. Lord knows how he'd use me against Teddy. All I know is that Teddy is going back to Italy and that I'll probably never see him again. I was getting worked up by then. And I love him so much, Larry. I really do. What shall I do? Lies, from beginning to end. You poor kid, said Larry. He said it so nicely, so sincerely. I was absolutely staggered by the difference in his tone. I was feeling more than a little sorry for myself at this point, but I was also feeling more than a little elated at the way I had cleared myself of the dreaded tourist charge, at the same time getting rid of Teddy so neatly, or at any rate disposing of him in the near future. We've been desperate these last months. We tried not to see each other, but it's no good. I'll die when he goes. By now I was really moved. My eyelids stung and tears began to roll slowly down my cheeks. Poor kid. Poor kid. He kept repeating. How nice Larry was now. Not mocking, not bored, not restless. I looked into his eyes, soft eyes, interested and sympathetic. He gave a short little laugh of encouragement. It stirred me to my roots. I took a long, heady swig of Pernod right into the hot, molten sun, and brother, that was my undoing. Take it easy, he was saying. Everything's going to be all right. He took my hand away from my drink, and I held it gently in his own. By now I was maybe drunk, I don't know, but in such a state of uncontrolled passion that the mere touch of his hand on mine charged through my body like 1,000 volts. You know how it is. Some people can hack and hack away at you, and nothing happens at all. And then someone else just touches you lightly on the arm, and it happens. Yes, I mean, I came. I mean, that's what happened. I remembered looking down at the table and seeing my fingers clinging and curling around his. I remember being quite aware of this, but at the same time quite unable to stop myself. Then I put his hand up to my cheek and caressed his knuckles with my mouth. A split second suspended itself into infinity in the air, while my heart pounded furiously and I kept kissing and kissing his knuckles. And then it was over. I jerked my head back sharply. I tried to pull my hand away from his. He held on tightly. His voice was very close to me, mocking and smooth. "Why, you little fraud!" Very softly, very clearly. "You shabby little fraud! You'll die when he goes, will you? Now, how do I know you've been lying?" He was quite simply torturing me. My eyes dug a hole in the table, unfortunately not large enough to crawl into. "You don't know," I began, but the whole thing was too much for me. There was one moment while I counted the seconds, and then I resigned myself. With a sigh, I forced myself to look at him, and he looked back at me hard and down and through, and I yielded up, without a struggle, my badly kept secret. "Isn't it awful?" I said, my voice faltering into a miserably insincere little giggle. He held his head on one side. He was, I could see, overwhelmingly puzzled. And so, in a word, was I. Had playing with fire for so long, without getting burnt, heated me up for this almost spontaneous combustion? Why was the question burning in his face? As there was no reason that I could figure out, he wasn't going to get an answer. And maybe he didn't really want one anyway. At any rate, he let go of my hand, and his motor started up again. The implications of these acts should have made me feel worse, but somehow they cooled me down, and I reached around for my tattered cloak of carelessness. I said casually, "I saw this stinking little art film last night. All about the simple life on the verge, up and down the Seine. How about that? Not a bad idea." I was really talking to myself. In times of stress, when I'm not coming out of things too well, the simple life has a tremendous appeal for me. Picking strawberries off a deserted wind-swept coast on the Atlantic Ocean when I was 7 is an image I frequently and yearningly return to. We began talking of other things. Although I had been the one to make such a fool of myself, I was the calmer. It was Larry who was flapping about, searching for conversation. At one point, I noticed his eyes had found their way back to my bosom again. I think that dress needs something or other around the neck, you know, he was saying helpfully. Haven't you got anything? I had a pearl necklace, I answered, by now really wishing he would go. I lost it, or something. Anyway, it's gone. The hell with it. What a shame. It wasn't real, I hope, he asked with a sympathy he couldn't feel. As a matter of fact, it was. Who cares? The hell with it, I said. I was really getting annoyed at the trivial turn in the conversation. Oh, come on, he persisted. You don't often lose things, do you? All the time, I said defiantly, wondering how long we were going to toss this around. I don't like possessions. I travel light so I can make my getaway. Bitterly, I was thinking that he was going to incorporate this too in his tourist research. Okay. Okay. I was it, all right. I was practically the prototype. Getting drunk, having affairs, losing money, losing jewelry, losing God knows what. Whoopee 23 Skido and all you get. You don't give a damn, do you? He said finally. No, I don't. A long pause. Gorse, I'll tell you something. You know what? You've got to stop all this drifting. You've got brains and looks and talent. Things could really happen to you. What's become of your acting? You weren't bad. You'd be sensational if you could project that offbeat thing that's you, really you. And what are you doing instead? Wasting your time bumming around with a tourist trap Casanova. Well, but living, you know, I said worriedly, at the same time trying to project that offbeat thing, whatever it was. Oh no, not that, please, he cut me off briskly. Look, I'll tell you what. I'm going to direct a program of one-act plays at the American Theater. You know, the little one around Denfeuille Rochereau, they keep trying to get started. It's just possible that you might be right for something. You might fit into the Saroyan play. We are playing safe and starting off with the usual stuff. Saroyan, Shaw, Tennessee Williams. Which ones? I asked breathlessly. Haven't decided yet. Anyway, come over there sometime. We'll be casting soon. Then, having made his decision and having wasted enough of his precious time that should no doubt have been spent geniusing, he shot to his feet and faced the cluster of waiters with such imminent departure in his manner that two of them came running. But I didn't care anymore. The whole flock of them could have come. The pernods melted in my stomach in one glorious swooshing splash, and all was gaiety and song and dance. Larry paid the bill and stood up, looking down at me and grinning. Gosh, I'd love to act again, I said. I really would. I'm dying to, but when? As soon as you get your laundry back, he said and left. Larry had gone. I drifted into the street, lit with love, and began turning imaginary handsprings. I hadn't the faintest idea where I was going. I found myself in front of the Metro Odeon and began playing with the metro map, pushing the buttons in two directions. Porte de Lila Châtelet. Marie d'ici Porte de la Chapelle. Vincent Nully. How beautiful this sounded. To the end of the line, I murmured. A virtuous thought crossed my mind that in this new life dedicated to art, I should take the metro, not taxis. But I found I couldn't bear to go underground into the dark. Not on a day like that. A taxi came by and I hailed it, suddenly knowing where I had to go. I told him to go directly to the American Library in Saint-Germain. There I would get out the collected works of Tennessee Williams and William Saroyan. Then I would go and see about my laundry. As if to emphasize the miracle of the day, the taxi driver actually conceded the quartier to be in his road. With a many "et bon bon ça va" to commemorate our fellow feelings, we drove off. Upon arrival, I glanced at my watch and saw that it was 1 o'clock. Everything would be closed until 3. The little hotel to which I had recently moved was on the Rue Jules Chapelet in Montparnasse, and so was the Tintoretterie where my laundry was marking time. It was a matter of 3 minutes away. 3 minutes or maximum, a mere flicker in the eternity of a taxi driver's life, you would think. But the doughty old Parisian at the wheel refused to budge another inch with me in the cab. 1 o'clock. 2 hours to go. I found a table at the Royal Saint-Germain, ordered an omelette au jambon and café noir, and stared across at the church with its towers encased in scaffolding. I wondered why I had never seen any workmen on it. Maybe I was up and about for only a few hours every day, after all. Boy, I'd better pull myself together. I made a mark with my knife on the paper tablecloth to underline my decision. Teddy would have to go. I probably really didn't have the true courtesan spirit anyway. How in hell had I got into all this in the first place? I tried to figure out how the whole thing started. Well, first of all, of course, I came to Paris. And the reason I had a chance to come to Paris was because of dear old Uncle Roger. The week before I became 13, 2 days after I'd run away for the fourth time, my Uncle Roger had sent for me. He was then living in a lofty majesty in a big white clapboard house overlooking the Hudson Valley, and spending most of this time in the enormous living room he'd had converted into an observatory. A giant telescope was rigged up right smack in the middle of the room, the original idea being that it would give him something to do when he got bored at one of his parties. But gradually it had come to obsess him, and he was never far away from it. He even began using it to punctuate his conversations, to gesture with the way other people use their spectacles and pipes. Uncle Roger had invented a special kind of screw which made him very, very rich, and a special kind of oracular noblesse oblige in distributing his largesse, which made him very, very godlike. The telescope helped too. He was hard at it when I was announced. They tell me we're heading down Mexico way this time. What for? He asked me over his shoulder, apparently unable even for a minute to tear himself away from the stars, or whatever you see through a telescope in broad daylight. I wanted to be a bullfighter, I mumbled. What were you going to be last time? You mean last year, when I ran away? Yes. A singer in a jazz band. Why? Nothing, nothing. Just curious. He twiddled a few knobs and had another look at the sun, I suppose, and finally turned around and looked at me. I was staring down at my saddle shoes. One shoelace had been badly tied and I was trying to retie it in my mind. My dear child, what a face! What a face to put on! Why so broody? I'm in mourning for my life, I said, still staring at my shoes, wishing they were black, at least, and wondering if he'd ever read the play. He hadn't. Good heavens! Is that what they teach you at that school? No. Well, never mind. Let's see what we can do to cheer you up, shall we? The reason I've asked you to come. Now, don't be afraid, I won't scold you. I'm sure you've been scolded quite enough. Sit down, child, sit down anywhere. Just throw all that camera stuff on the floor. We are shooting Venus tonight, getting her quarter face. The reason I asked you to come is to find out what you'd like for your birthday this year. I want my freedom, I said, tears stinging my eyes at the word. Your freedom? Ah, yes, of course. What are you planning to do with it? I hesitated. I had to think for a moment. I hadn't really put it into words before. I want to stay out as late as I like and eat whatever I like anytime I want to, I said finally. Is that all? No. I think if I had my freedom, I wouldn't allow myself to get introduced to all the mothers and fathers and brothers of the girls at school and all that junk. I wouldn't get introduced to anyone. I've never wanted to meet anyone I've been introduced to. I want to meet all the other people. I can't explain. Try. There must be some reason for your ambulatory urges. It's just that I know the world is so wide and full of people and exciting things that I just go crazy every day stuck in these institutions. I mean, if I don't get started soon, how will I get the chance to sharpen my wits? It takes a lot of training. You have to start very young. I want them to be so sharp that I'm always able to guess right. Not be right. That's much different. That means you're going to do something about it. No, just guessing. You know, more on the wing. Uncle Roger went back to the telescope and swung it around a bit, back and forth. Finally, he came over and sat down beside me. For the first time, he spoke to me, man to man. I think I understand your predilection for being continually on the wing, or rather, to put it more precisely, on the lam, he said seriously. It's difficult to know nowadays where adventure lies. There are no more real frontiers. Funny how these things work out. I came roaring out of the Middle West, you know, and my greatest ambition was to conquer, that's how I say it, to conquer New York. New York and the mysterious civilized East. Now, my father before me had set his sights on conquering the Middle West. That was his adventure. I wonder, what you will try to conquer? Europe, I suppose, since our family seems to be going backwards. I don't know why, but at this moment I had one of those aberrations where people say one thing to you and you take it to mean something quite different. I fully expected Uncle Roger to put a steamship ticket in one of my hands, a bouquet of flowers in the other, and wish me bon voyage. I drew myself to attention, trying to look alert, composed, above all trustworthy, and I said, "I should like to go to Europe very much, Uncle Roger. Could you write to my school and explain that you've decided to send me away?" "Good God, this is impossible," exclaimed my uncle, horrified. "See here, young lady, the world may be very wide, but you also are very young, and don't you forget it." "Now then," he said, and he took me by the elbows and looked earnestly into my eyes, "I have a proposition to make to you. The more I see of the world, the more I realize how much we are haunted by our childhood dreams. We have been having a serious conversation just now, whether you know it or not. I want you to remember every word. And when you've graduated from college..."
"Oh no!"
"Graduated from college, and if you haven't run away in the meantime, I'll give you your freedom. 2 years of it. Upon graduation, you will receive in monthly sums enough money for you to go anywhere you like and do anything you like during that period. No strings. I don't even want to hear of you in those 2 years. Afterwards, come back and tell me what it was like." When I first arrived in Paris, I got sick. Then I got well and began walking everywhere round and round and round, crossing and recrossing the river, hardly knowing where I was going or where I'd been. Hardly caring, it all seemed so fine. And then, one day, one memorable day in the early evening, I stumbled across the Champs-Élysées. I know it seems crazy to say, but before I actually stepped onto it, at what turned out to be the Étoile, I had not even been aware of its existence. No, I swear it. I'd heard the words Champs-Élysées, of course, but I thought it was a park or something. I mean, that's what it sounds like, doesn't it? All at once, I found myself standing there, gazing down that enchanted boulevard in the blue, blue evening. Everything seemed to fall into place. Here was all the gaiety and glory and sparkle I knew was going to be life, if I could just grasp it. I began floating down those Elysian fields 3 inches off the ground as easily as a Cocteau character floats through hell. Luxury and order seemed to be shining from every street lamp along the avenue, shining from every window of its toy shops and dress shops and car shops, shining from its cafes and cinemas and theaters, from its bonbonneries and parfumeries and nightheries. Talk about seeing eternity in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower. I really think I was having some sort of mystic revelation then. The whole thing seemed like a memory from the womb. It seemed to have been waiting there for me. For some people, history is a beach or a tower or a graveyard. For me, it was this giant, primordial toy shop with all its windows gloriously ablaze. It contained everything I've ever wanted that money can buy. It was an enormous Christmas present wrapped in silver and blue tissue paper, tied with satin ribbons and bells. Inside would be something to adorn, to amuse, and to dazzle me forever. It was my present for being alive. As I say, I'd started at the Etoile and was working my way down to the Place de la Concorde. Somewhere around the Rond-Point, I floated off the curb and into an oncoming car. The scream of brakes that had at first seemed so dim and irrelevant was now screeching into my ears. All in all, it was a very near miss. The driver leapt out of the car and rushed over to the lamppost against which I was limply draped. "Are you all right?" he asked anxiously. I could have kissed him for not yelling, "Why the hell hadn't I looked where I was going?" I nodded and started to leave, but found that it was quite impossible to put one foot in front of the other. The upshot of the matter was that this extremely charming man, his arm firmly under my elbow, suggested we both take a spin in his car for a little while to unwind. The next thing I knew, I was ankle deep in martinis at the Ritz bar, and he was calling me Sally J, and I was calling him Teddy. I sighed nostalgically, drained my coffee to the grounds, and unrolled l'addition from the tight little scroll in my hand. If I was going to break off with Teddy, it wouldn't do at all to remember those early days and what fun they'd been. After all, he was madly attractive, dans sa façon, no question. Was I being wise or merely rash? Oh dear. By now I was completely uncertain. Two of les boys flitted past. They certainly wore their jeans with a difference. One of the differences between Saint-Germain and Montparnasse, I decided, was that Saint-Germain was queerer. And that was the only decision I seemed likely to make for the time being.